Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room, Ken Peterson is leading the Bible study on Job, the comforting friends. So let's listen in on Ken Peterson.
We're calling this session the comforting friends. Although we were introduced to the first comforting friend at the last session, some of you are new here today, and you'll just have to read back in your Bible as to what has transpired before this point. We're going to pick it up chapter 8 in Job. Already we know that Job is in a terrible situation and awful condition. He has sores up and down his body. He has lost his possessions. He has lost his children. Everything that you could anticipate happening to somebody that would be a calamity has happened to Job. And Job is sitting here in front of us now, and we're asked to look at him as his friends. Here is Job sitting on a bed of ashes. And he has already loathed his life. He has already wished that he were dead. His friends come, and when they first come, they can't say a thing to him. They don't even recognize him. In one sense, they didn't recognize him. He was so different from what they had remembered. And they tore their clothes, and they, as was the case, to show their sadness and their sorrow and their grief over what has happened to their friend Job. And we're told, for 7 days and seven nights, they didn't say anything. They just sat with him. But then Job speaks first. And Job speaks of how he feels, what his emotional state is, and of course it isn't very good. And this is kind of the cue for the friends to begin to say something. And we have to remember that these are friends who have come to comfort Job. And I'm inviting you to take on some of these roles. I've invited Bill over here to be Bill Dad. I was indicating before, you know, that it would be easier for us today, instead of saying Eliphaz, to say Eli, and very much shorter. Instead of saying Bildad, we're not familiar with Bildad, but we are familiar with Bill, and as a matter of fact, we even have a Bill to help us here understand what's going on. And instead of Zophar, we'll make it much more inclusive. We'll cut it to Zol, and we'll bring in the women who might also be a friend of Job and see suffering from a different point of view, perhaps. So let us begin. And Bildad, we'll ask Bill to say the comforting word, if you will, to Job. And the rest of us can listen. And if you have something you want to say then, to add to what Bill might say, let's do so. We're at chapter 8. Okay, Bill.
Well, there's obviously a couple of things that you need to be reminded of. One is that the fact that your sons have been killed is undoubtedly because they're punished for their sins. And because that's the way the world's set up. And that's the way God set it up, and so it's nothing really that it was your fault, because they would be punished for their own sin. But the thing I'm concerned about most is that you seem to be very negative, and you seem to have assumed somehow that God isn't going to come through and be of any help to you. And of course that's dead wrong, because everybody who knows anything knows that if you're a righteous person, you're a good person, and you plead with God, and you try to develop a deeper relationship with God, that you will be rewarded. And all this business about complaining and so forth really is not going to do you any good. So as your friend, I would suggest that you may have to be patient, have to wait it through, but if you're a good man, you will definitely be rewarded, because that's the way God set up the world. So I think you just sort of need to work through this, and I don't think complaining is really helpful.
All right, anyone who wants to respond as if you were Job,
Ouch.
One response, ouch.
He's not being fair. He's my friend, but he's chastising me. I don't think that's much of a friend.
Well, friends should be honest with each other, though, I think. It would be helpful, concerned.
Maybe so, Bill.
Out of them. Anyone else?
Just come right back after this.
Well, just telling him to wait and be patient is not much comfort, is it? I mean, today is today, and what are you going to do with it if you're just supposed to last until next Tuesday?
Well, okay, and you're speaking kind of like Joel. Bet you didn't even know that.
No.
All right. What do you say to that, Bill?
Well, but the world is set up by God in such a way that if you're a good person, you will be rewarded. And it doesn't pay to just assume that's not going to happen. I mean, if that's the way it's set up, that's the way it's going to happen. It isn't like God's not arbitrary. Arguing with God isn't going to do any good. It never has. And so I don't see if that's being mean or anything.
What you're saying, then, is that you just accept it.
In a sense, sure, yeah. If you're a good person. Now, if you did something wrong, then of course you will be punished.
Well, is this punishment now?
Well, your point of view seems to be that you are a righteous person, and therefore that you have not done anything wrong. And if that's true, and the world is set up in a very strict cause-effect type relation, then you will be rewarded for being a good person. I mean, that's the way the scriptures tell us, the elders tell us that's the way things are. I have no reason to doubt it.
But Bill, when? I mean, do I have to go through this? You've not walked in my moccasins and you're giving me advice. You don't know what I'm going through.
Well, no, we're not really discussing my particular autobiography.
I know we're not. You're telling me.
Well, I'm sympathetic. I mean, I know it's a difficult time, and it's a rough thing to go through, but you just have to wait it through and realize that God will reward the good person.
Take that in, if you will. Isn't that essentially what Bildad says? As a matter of fact, not only Bildad, it's Eli and Zoe, they all seem to think the same way. God will reward a good person. If you're going through a lot of trouble like Job is, what does that suggest?
Maybe you're not so good.
Maybe you're not so good. Well, okay. Job is stubborn, though, isn't he? And we'll pick this up. That was essentially chapter 8, done very well by Bill over here. Job replies, and let's listen to what Job has to say.
Sort of changes the terms of the argument.
He does. Do you want to read that, starting with chapter 9?
Then Job answered, "Truly I know that it is so, but how can a man be just before God? If one wished to contend with him, one could not answer him once in 1,000 times. He is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and succeeded? He who removes mountains and they know it not, when he overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble, who commands the sun and it does not rise, who seals up the stars, who alone stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea, who made the Bear and the Orion, the Pleiades and the chambers of the sun, who does great things beyond understanding and marvelous things without number. Lo, he passes by me and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him. But behold, he snatches away. Who can hinder him? Who will say to him, what doest thou?"
Okay.
Somebody else
here. Okay, let's stop there. Any comment about this now? Job is answering. He's still very much in expressing how he feels about all of this.
But he's saying God is so powerful and so distant that there's no way I can make myself right with it.
Yeah. Yes.
But isn't he, in the beginning, agreeing with Bildad by saying, nobody is righteous. I know that this is true. How can a mortal man, a mortal, be righteous before God? Then I wish to dispute with him, he had no answer. You're convicted.
That's right. In other words, Job is not disagreeing with what Bildad has said in that sense. He's
but in
not.
A way he's saying, what you're telling me to do is impossible.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay.
He's also kind of saying, so what?
Okay. So where does this leave Job? Without what? There's nothing much he can do? Anyone else then? Let's pick it up and we'll continue this. This saga, this drama with Job. Anybody go ahead and pick it up there in verse 13.
God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him bowed the helpers of Rahab. Then how can I answer him, choosing my words with him? Though I am innocent, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. If I summoned him and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with a tempest, and he multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not let me get my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it is a contest of strength, behold him. If it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am innocent, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse. I am blameless, I regard not myself, I loathe my life. It is all one. Therefore I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. The earth is given to the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, who then is it?
Okay. He destroys both the blameless and the wicked. No distinction whatsoever, is there?
And he's calling into question the whole theology.
He is.
He doesn't agree with Bildad. He doesn't agree with anybody.
Yeah.
He's really calling into question the whole thing, the whole basis of it.
Yeah, because Bildad had assumed that if you were good,
you'd be rewarded.
You'd be
rewarded.
If you were
bad, you'd be punished. He's saying, uh-uh.
That's not the case. That's not the way it is in the world. Isn't that what he's saying? That's not the way it is. That's not the answer then. When disaster brings sudden death, God mocks at the calamity of the innocent. Saying some bad things about God there. If it is true what Bildad has said, the earth is given into the hand of the wicked. The stuff about the wicked are going to be punished and all that doesn't seem to be so as far as Job is concerned here. They prosper. In fact, later on they'll say, why do the wicked prosper and the innocent not? You know. So he's asking these questions. He covers the eyes of his judges. If it is not God, who then is it? Well, let's go on. Jack?
You gonna want me again?
Mm-hmm.
My days are swifter than a runner. They flee away, they see no good. They go by like skiffs of reed, like an eagle swooping on the prey. If I say I will forget my complaint, I'll put off my sad countenance and be of good cheer. I become afraid of all my suffering, for I know thou wilt not hold me innocent. I shall be condemned. Why then do I labor in vain? If I wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye, yet thou wilt plunge me into a pit. And my clothes will abhor me, for he is not a man as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. There is no umpire between us who might lay his hand upon us both. Let him take his rod away from me, and let not dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak without fear of him, for I am not so in myself. He's stripped.
Okay. What speaks out of this section here? To you, anybody?
It sounds almost hopeless.
Sounds hopeless?
Yeah. No matter what he does. I wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands, and yet he'll plunge me into a pit. It doesn't sound like he's very cheerful.
He's anything but cheerful, and anything but happy over his situation, and anything but happy over what he has heard so far from his friends.
Yeah, and he's particularly unhappy because he thinks it's unjust and without meaning.
Yes. When you feel that way about something, it's really hard, isn't it?
He feels he has no communication with God, no basis of communication. They're okay. Often separate divisions.
He has, the friends have given him a sense of theology about God and how God relates to the human situation. But it hasn't been very comforting for him. He doesn't have this communication that he's longing for. It's interesting to me that he puts in here, there is no umpire between us.
Yeah, that sounds modern, doesn't it? Yeah.
We would say, probably another way of saying that, there's no mediator. Who understands me and who also is close to God. Now, what comes to your mind now?
There is one mediator.
There is.
God, man.
Yes. It's interesting here that in this book of Job, where they're looking for a mediator, I mean, he says there's no umpire. He's longing for someone who can come between and bridge the gap between humanity and God, between the human situation and God's desire for the situation. You know, what is God's will for us? To bridge the gap in such a way that we can understand, right?
Is there a fire alarm?
Somebody.
Somebody's taking a shower and didn't turn off the vent.
Now I'm trying to recall what they told us to do, but this isn't...
Stay where we are.
Stay where we are, right.
Hear the bell in this building, then...
I see somebody running in.
Going to the control center, something that's not working properly.
Somebody pulled the lever with their glasses off and got this light.
We're safe.
Well, now that with that little bit of
there's the umpire right there.
Hesitation.
Yeah.
Oops. Look, the whole village is burnt down. When she speaks.
I hope it wasn't one of my mice that got sick. They're getting mad at me, getting some fun. What's she saying?
But right now, in this recording, we're hearing a fire alarm going off, and so it's kind of stopped us a moment. And now it has just stopped. And we'll find out later, I guess, what that was all about. Well, let's pick it up. We've been talking about no umpire. No umpire between us. Who might lay his hand on us both. Hand on me and the hand on God. If he would take his rod away from me and not let dread of him terrify me, then I would speak without fear of him. For I know that I am not what I am thought to be. If you think about Jesus, one of the things that he says, in a sense, and is for us, is a mediator. He's one that we feel free to talk to. Or to confide in, to understand. He understands our plight and our situation. And also, he certainly can tell us and reflects the will of God for us and the very presence of God for us. Well, this is what Job was wanting. This is getting to be most distracting right now.
I'm going to take a 5-minute break.
Should we just take about a 5-minute break? I don't think we're concentrating on
children
right
now. Let them work it out after.
It's almost over. Usually it goes about this long. But she's still speaking, so continue until she stops speaking.
Well, And again, you know, it's kind of like saying, and if we are relating ourselves now to Jesus, Jesus was the one they longed for who could see as we see, could understand us as we understand, that we could feel that here's someone who understands our situation, our plight. Are your days like the days of mortals, or your years like human years, that you seek out my iniquity, you search for my sin, although you know that I'm not guilty, and there is no one to deliver out of your hand? Your hands fashioned and made me, and now you turn and destroy me. Remember that you fashioned me like clay, and will you turn me to dust again? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? You clothed me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews. You have granted me life and steadfast love, and your care has preserved my spirit. And yet, these things you hid in your heart. I know that this was your purpose. If I sin, you watch me and do not acquit me of my iniquity. If I am wicked, woe to me. If I am righteous, I cannot lift up my head, for I am filled with disgrace. And look upon my affliction, bold as a lion you hunt me. You repeat your exploits against me. You renew your witnesses against me and increase your vexation toward me. You bring fresh troops against me. Why did you bring me forth from the womb? Would that I had died before any eye had seen me, and were as though I had not been carried from the womb to the grave. Are not the days of my life few? Let me alone, that I may find a little comfort before I go, never to return to the land of gloom and deep darkness, the land of gloom and chaos, where light is like darkness. Job has spoken. Deep misery. He contends with God, not afraid of God. He says he has a problem that he's dealing with here, and it's very confusing for him. And the third friend comes. And this time, her name is Zoe.
Yeah. Well, Zoe essentially says that God would not exact of you less than your guilt deserves. In other words, Zoe's pretty much figuring he's guilty, but God would not ask more of him than his guilt deserves. And Zoe says, if you, you know, set your heart aright, you will stretch out your hand to God for forgiveness. And then you'll be secure and will not fear. So, in other words...
Here's Job. Yeah. You're talking to him. In other words, what?
Job needs to get down on his knee and ask for forgiveness and disregard, I mean, not argue with him about his guilt or lack of guilt. That's not the point. Just get down and...
All right. So the friend Zoe has come to comfort. Yes.
Is he responding again to the accusation, you are guilty? Here then, verse 2, chapter 10, he said, I will say to God, do not condemn me, but tell me what charges you have against me. Saying, show me my guilt. You know, show me the reason why I'm being punished in this way. I know I'm guilty, but... But specifically, and this is where Bildad was coming, if you confess your specific sin, God will forgive you and you'll bless you. And so Job is now saying,
where are
okay,
they?
Which one?
Which one of the many, huh?
Mm-hmm.
See, I think one of the things that's going on here is something the friends don't even deal with, and that is, in a sense, what Job's saying is, I want to be treated as special. That is, he's saying, okay, you can give me all these categories, and you can give me this ideology, and you can give me this orthodox religion, but I want to be treated as special. I mean, you folks may think that everything's taken care of with the reward, the good, and punish the wicked, but that doesn't work for me. I want to get right in contact with God and argue it out with him, and because I'm special. And I think, at least, this, that because... I mean, Bildad and Zoe and Elihu don't say, they don't say anything about wanting a special audience, right?
No.
They don't want an audience with the Pope. but what Job is saying, he wants an audience. And he wants to go to court with him and, you know, have a trial, so to speak. He's like, he wants to be treated special. And it's interesting, nobody condemns him for that. That was kind of... Do you think that's true, that he's asking to be treated as special?
Well, I think he just... I don't know if it's treating as special as much as it is that he wants to be in dialogue with God directly. I guess that you could say that. None of the others are asking.
They don't care about being in dialogue with God directly because it's already been worked out anyway. They figured out their theology. They don't need a dialogue with God.
They've got all their religion in order.
Yeah, they've got it in order.
But they're not desperate.
Right, exactly. They're not hurting. They're not hurting. Yeah.
Why does that make a difference, would you say?
Well, he's totally... Job is totally centered in himself because he is so totally miserable. Uh-huh. And that's why he is thinking in terms of God and himself, not of God and the world at large.
Right.
And the world at large is not thinking in terms of themselves and God because they're not miserable. I don't know if that's right.
I think that's right. Uh-huh. I think what you're saying is that focus is done upon you when you really are miserable.
Mm-hmm.
You can have your faith statement in pretty good order, but it's really tested when you're miserable. Then you begin to ask some questions. Then you want to have more of a direct contact with God, not simply some statements that you can draw upon. And that is exactly what Job says here. So what I'm hearing is that you're not, you don't think that Zoe's doing too well either as a friend, huh?
She's a nice girl, but she's not.
Well, it doesn't get any better as you go into this. And we're not going to have time to go through it all, but I'd like to suggest now that we move and skip a few chapters because, in a sense, Job's response is that he's a laughing stock, but he upholds the fact that he is blameless. He wants God to show him where his mistakes are, come and face him so that he can speak his peace to God, defend himself before God. We're going to go to 15. And here we come to Eli again. And Eli speaks to Job. Do we have someone that will volunteer to read now? Anybody?
But a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill himself with the east wind. Should he argue in unprofitable talk or in words with which he can do no good? But you are doing away with the fear of God and hindering meditation before God. For your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, and not I. Your own lips testify against you.
Now, what is Eli saying here? Why does he say that? You dare to stand up to God? You dare to claim that you're blameless? Without sin, without guilt.
Job is suggesting blasphemy.
Blasphemy. Yeah, you're really standing up against God, but you should accept the fact of your condition, your situation, and follow our advice, and you would be relieved of that, of your present plight. Okay, you see, you're doing away with the fear of God, he said. You know, you undermine religion. And you're hindering meditation before God. Okay, let's go on then. Yes.
Are you the first man that was born? Or were you brought forth before the hills? Have you listened to the counsel of God? And do you limit wisdom to your soul? What do you know that we do not know? What do you understand that it's not clear to us? Both the gray haired and the aged are among us, older than your father. Are the consolations of God too small for you, or the word that deals, or the word that deals gently with you? Why does your heart carry you away? And why do your eyes flash that you have turned your spirit against God and let such words go forth out of your mouth? What is man that he can be pleased? Or is he that the born of a woman that he could be righteous? Behold, God puts no trust in his holy ones.
Even in his holy ones, isn't that said? It says even in ours. It's kind of like putting a little more emphasis in that. You know, you don't trust mortals. Not even those holy ones does he put his trust in. Okay.
And the heavens are not even in his sight. How much less one who is abominable and corrupt and drinks iniquity like water?
Oh, that's nice. Let's stop right there. Any comments on this?
Getting more and more comforting, isn't it?
Eliphaz is digging his own pit. There's going to be justice here somewhere. This is, you see this kind of thing all the time. The friend comes and says, well, tell me how you feel. And you tell the friend how you feel, and the friend takes the words you just spoke and uses them to shut you down. This is not a very friendly thing. But then he says, have you listened in on the counsel of God? And I'm thinking, well, if Eliphaz had listened in to the counsel of God at the beginning, he'd know that Job was right.
Yeah.
Job didn't do anything to justify this disaster. In fact, the fact that the disaster came was because Job was righteous, according to the counsel of God at the beginning of the book.
Point was, yes, according to that, it's a test, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
I hear Alfred making a switch in simply trying to explain to Job why this happened to one of accusing him now of compounding a problem by denying what Eliphaz and others had told him in the first round.
Yeah, he's, well, and as a matter of fact, that's exactly what happens in the discourses. You take the first discourse, it's bad enough. Second discourse, it's a little worse. Because it compounds. And when the friends come in, remember, they're going to speak, and they're going to be more and more defensive and more trying to reinforce their position against Job and try to find, they become much more accusing as they go along, right?
Does that have something to do with the friends' discomfort at Job's, their own discomfort, and therefore they're telling Job how he should be so they'll feel better?
Well, I
think they're responding to Job questioning what they believe.
Mm-hmm. And it's making them uncomfortable.
Yeah, they've moved from comforting him to being irked at his frame of mind and his belief and his challenging what they believe to be so.
Mm-hmm. That's right. They're uneasy, question about it. But in their uneasiness, it seems like they take on the accusatory position, doesn't it? I think that's right. And it becomes a defensive position.
Which they're trying to justify their own theology, are they not?
Yeah. I think that's certainly in there, yes.
It just came to me that they're basing their position on this is what people have always believed. Mm-hmm. Job is saying, God, what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You judge me, reveal to me why this is happening.
So you can begin to see why this might be looked upon by the friend as undermining religion. You're not accepting what everyone believes, or what has become the kind of the conventional religion of our time that supports us and gives us encouragement in the midst of suffering. Now Job is saying, I'm going directly and find out God's counsel on this thing. No. Does God believe as all others have come to believe? I think that's right on. Seems to me that's exactly what I see here, and as I read this. You know, are you the firstborn of the human race? Here again, you get to the place of boy, he's rather upset with Job. Were you brought forth before the hills, and so on? You know, who are you? Are you special like you were talking about?
Does that also mean, is it a reference to Genesis and the story of Adam? Is it a reference to the innocence? Is it a reference to, do you think you're innocent? As, I mean, I don't know how familiar with the author of this material would be with that narrative, but that could be a possibility of saying, what do you think you are, an innocent firstborn? So
that's right. I think he's familiar with that. Coming as when this did. Well, let's go on. I'm going to have a skip to another place where chapter 16, Job reaffirms his innocence, and let's have someone read that, if you will.
Then Job answered, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. Shall windy words have an end? Or what provokes you that you answer? I could also speak as you do, if you were in my place. I could join words together against you and shake my head at you. I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips would assuage your pain. If I speak, my pain is not assuaged, and if I forbear, how much of it leaves me. Surely now God has worn me out, and he has made desolate all my company, and he has shriveled me up, which is a witness against me, and my leanness has risen up against me. It testifies to my face.
Go ahead.
He has torn me in his wrath and hated me. He has gnashed his teeth at me. My adversary sharpens his eyes against me. Men have gaped at me with their mouth. They have struck me insolently upon the cheek. They mass themselves together against me. God gives me up to the ungodly and cast me into the hands of the wicked.
Okay, we stop there. Okay. Because later on it goes on, Job just sees how God is just really doing some bad things to him. Down here in verse 20, my friends scorn me, my eyes pour out tears to God, that he would maintain the right of a mortal with God, as one does for a neighbor. But when a few years have come, I shall go the way from which I shall not return. Talking about, you will die, you weep, right? And Job then prays for relief in chapter 17. Bill comes back, and we begin another round with the comforters. Bill says again that God punishes the wicked, and obviously, since you're going through so much misery, you must be punished because of your wickedness. And Job replies in 19, Job answered, how long will you torment me and break me in pieces with words? These 10 times you have cast reproach upon me. Are you not ashamed to wrong me? He challenges them. And then he gets to the place with a very familiar portion that has been turned into song. As we go into 19, I'll read it from verse 13 of 19. He has put my family far from me. My acquaintances are wholly estranged from me. My relatives and my close friends have failed me. The guests in my house have forgotten me. My serving girls count me as a stranger. I've become an alien in their eyes. Everything has changed for Job. I call to my servant, but he gives me no answer. I must myself plead with him. My breath is repulsive to my wife. I am loathsome to my own family. Even young children despise me. When I rise, they talk against me. All my intimate friends abhor me, and those whom I loved have turned against me. My bones cling to my skin and to my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. Have pity on me, have pity on me, O you, my friends, for the hand of God has touched me. Why do you, like God, pursue me, never satisfied with my flesh? And then, oh, that my words were written down. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. Oh, that with an iron pen and with lead, they were engraved on a rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives. Do you know that that came from Job? We sing it very often, don't we, at various times. And that at the last he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been thus destroyed, then in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see on my side, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. My heart faints within me. If you say, how we will persecute him, and the root of the matter is found in him. Be afraid of the sword, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, so that you may know there is a judgment. Well, Zoe comes in again. Wickedness receives just retribution. It's the same old argument. If the wicked have to be punished, the good are rewarded. And Job replies again on chapter 21. What does he say here? Let's pick it up there. This is Job's reply to the fact of what he's heard all this time. Someone from the first row? You want to read it?
Then Job answered, "Listen carefully to my words, and let this be your consolation. Bear with me, and I will speak, and after I have spoken, mock on. As for me, is my complaint against man? Why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be appalled. Lay your hand upon your mouth. When I think of it, I am dismayed, and shuddering seizes my flesh. Why do the wicked live, reach old age, and grow mighty in power? Their children are established in their presence, their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, and no rod of God is upon them. Their bull breeds without fail, their cow calves and does not cast her calf. They send forth their little ones like a flock, and their children dance. They sing to the tambourine and the lyre, and rejoice to the sound of the pipe. They spend their days in prosperity, and peace they go down to show. They say to God, depart from us. We do not desire the knowledge of thy ways. What is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit do we get if we pray to him? Behold, is not their prosperity in their hand? The counsel of the wicked is far from me."
Okay, let's stop right there. What's going on here? Isn't it true? Job is saying that the wicked go often unpunished.
Prosper.
And not only unpunished, but they prosper. And that is very difficult to accept if you have the idea that the wicked will get their just due. You know? The wicked are punished. So Job is saying just the opposite here, isn't he? They often do not. And that raises the question, well, why be good then? Doesn't it? Have you ever heard anyone think that way? Yeah, what good is it to be religious? What good does it do you? What is the reward? Isn't this what they say? And you think that, particularly down here in my translation that I have, the new Revised Standard Version here, that in verse 14 of chapter 21, they spend their days in prosperity, and in peace they go down to Sheol, kind of the waiting place. They say to God, leave us alone. Leave us alone. We do not desire to know your ways. Ever known persons like that? What is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit do we get if we pray to him? Is not their prosperity indeed their own achievement? The plans of the wicked are repugnant to me. He's saying that though, right? But nevertheless, don't give me the argument that if you're righteous, then you're going to be rewarded, and if you're wicked, you're going to be punished. It doesn't work out that way. It doesn't seem to anyway in the world. Okay, any comment here?
Well, he's making a couple pretty significant assumptions there. One is that he knows who the wicked are. Another assumption he makes is that the only possible definition of reward is wealth, prosperity. That's sort of like, those are fairly significant assumptions to make.
Yeah.
He knows who the good are and who the wicked are. And the wicked are making it, and therefore they've been rewarded, and so on, and that's not right. But those are very interesting assumptions to make. Like, I think I might say to him too, who do you think, how do you know all that?
How do you know that? That's right. But for the sake of the argument.
I see why he feels that way.
For the sake of the argument, he's saying that. And how does he know that?
Of course, he had his moments of prosperity.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, it wasn't because you were necessarily just prosperous. He must have known something else about some of these people that who were prosperous but were not honest or whatever. It doesn't indicate how he knew this. But I think for the sake of the argument, what he's saying here is that there are, among all these prosperous people that are getting along so well, they're not all righteous.
The thing that amazes me is this knowledge that he has. You would think he would have gotten over a lifetime, and yet none of it comes out till he's hit.
Yeah, right.
I see, yeah.
And I just find that kind of interesting, because obviously it wasn't something he just thought about after everything was taken away from him.
That's right. You mean he was thinking this way earlier?
Yeah, maybe not.
Before this ever happened to him.
Right,
but never expressed it. At least we don't know that.
Probably. It would bother him a lot more that the wicked prosper once his prosperity has ended.
Right.
You know, it's one thing to prosper and look around and see people that you don't think deserve to. It's another thing to be in abject poverty and misery and see the wicked prosper.
Yeah. Well, that's right, eh? You know, the rest of it here, and we only have about 7 minutes to go. There is again another, the continuing saga with these friends, Eli, and then Bildad comes back, saying again, "Can a mortal be righteous before God?" And Joel
introduces a new issue. If that's the case, Bildad is making a shift here, I think.
And what
well,
way?
Well, now he's in a sense he is agreeing with Job. But as he's saying, okay, now how can a man be righteous before God? That is a question, and what he then winds up with in chapter 26 is he says, well, you have to realize you just can't understand God. I mean, the God is really all-powerful and great, and you don't amount to that much. And so he sort of shifted from the good and the bad and the reward and the other, you know, and saying, well, I think he's saying like St. Paul says, we just don't know. We see through a glass darkly here, and which I think that's part of what he's saying.
Well, that's Job is saying that. God's majesty is unsearchable. In 26.
Oh, I see, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Job still maintains his integrity as you go on through here. Then there's an interlude in Job, and the more I tried to study that, I couldn't understand they had different ideas as to why this appears at this point. But it's a statement about where wisdom is to be found. And then Job finishes his defense in chapter 29. And if we go on, We're going to skip a whole section of another discourse and get down to 38. I just wanted to at least have a chance to say how that finally the dialogue does take place between Job and God. And the Lord answers Job out of what they call out of the whirlwind and speaks to him. And here is what he has to say. And you said something, I think, Bill, about Terry, is it Terrian?
Samuel Terrian.
Samuel Terrian. But he says, and maybe you could comment about that after I read this first portion here. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy. Or who shut in the sea with the doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment, and thick darkness a swaddling band, and prescribed bounds for it, and set bars and doors, and said, thus far you shall come, and no further, and here shall your proud ways be stopped. He's talking in a very poetic way about how God created it all, and is asking now, Job, where were you when all of this was done? But he goes on in an interesting way here. He says, have you commanded the morning since their days begun? It began. And cause this dawn to know its place, so that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth, and the wicked be shaken out of it. It is changed like clay under the seal, and it is dyed like a garment. Light is withheld from the wicked, and their uplifted arm is broken. Have you entered into the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all this. And he goes on and goes on. And in verse 31, an interesting portion here where he throws a challenge to Job. Can you bind the chains of Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth the Maseroth in their season? Or can you guide the bear with his children? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you establish a rule of the earth? He's talking about all of creation and where you were in that point. Later in chapter 40, the Lord said to Job, shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? Anyone who argues with God must respond. And Job's response to God, then Job answered the Lord, see, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer. Twice, but not will proceed no further. God's challenge then to Job. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Gird up your loins. And he says it again. He gets to verse 15. Look at Behemoth. You know what Behemoth is? Hippopotamus kind of creature. Huge. Yeah. Which I made just as I made you. It eats grass like an ox. Its strength is in its loins, and its power in the muscles of its belly. It makes its tail stiff like a cedar, and the sinews of its thighs are knit together. Its bones are tubes of bronze. Its limbs like bars of iron. It is the first of the great acts of God. Only its maker can approach it with a sword, for the mountains yield food for it, where all the wild animals play, and under the lotus plants it lies. And he goes on in 41, can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook, or press down its tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in its nose, or pierce its jaw with a hook?